bones of their ancestors, still waiting for the end that was every Chiloto's due. Condry tried to imagine them. Ghoul-gnawed femurs and skulls, clavicles, ribs, in heaps and piles, bleached after decades in the sun. Why had they not been burned? Were they not taught as children that no ghost could rest easy until his bones received the dignity of fire? His legs were numb from standing still. He thought of his mother's parents and brother. Their bones must be in the theater, too. Had they been part of the spectacle? Had Vajix laughed, placed bets as the ghouls chased them down? Slurp, hiss, snap. Condry flinched again. Jashar, what's making those sounds? All at once, the mob shifted, murmuring. She is here. She is here. Every head turned westward, and those not bound to duty stations jostled for a view. At the foot of the hill, a podium had been raised. Condry could barely see it. The crowd was muttering, Yes, someone is climbing a ladder. Yes, yes, it is her radiance. She is here with her sons.
Put out your torches, children, and your lamps. Put out every light.
It was her voice. Magnified by science or sorcery, it rolled like thunder across the land. Instantly, the lights began to vanish. Condry tried to breathe normally. Like everyone, he felt the dangerous thrill of her presence. The liberator, this destroyer of all enemies, this weapon of the gods. But more than that, he felt her love. At long last, he truly felt it, washing over him, warm and sweet as rose nectar. A flood of certainties. A home. The last fires were extinguished. The darkness was complete. Condry let himself grin. He felt so good. It was almost a delirium, like drinking wine with Arikina, feeling her readiness for him, falling into her arms.
Chilotos, said the prophet, I have not come here to speak many words. You have already heard me, heeded me. You are my beloved faithful. You know who guides my steps, and you know the ground we have walked together. The past that made us, the road washed in blood. You know how they used us, enslaved us, scraped out our land like a melon rind. Our land and our hearts.
Was he crying? Was that allowed? Condry lifted his chin, straightened his back, begged the gods to let him be the man he should be, just this once.
You know how they tired of us and sent us to the slaughter, said the prophet. How they toiled for a world where Chiloto would join Nitani and Birlama, Adis Akalat and Srel, the dark list of extinguished peoples, the dead forever. All this you know. You will take a private oath tonight to tell your children this story, and you will nurture this pain we share, this burning in your blood and mine, and distill from it your essential selves. Do you hear me? You will make of it not the venom that weakens you, but the elixir that makes you indestructible. They fear us, my children. But they will come to fear us more.
Motion on the platform. The prophet's voice came more faintly and with a hint of irritation.
That's enough. I'm finished. Help me down, Jihalkra. Bring my pet.
She is going, the crowd's whisper announced. Her sons are leading her away. But was it possible? Could that truly be all? They were blessed, of course. Blessed and grateful. She had made the journey, called them her children. It was enough. But what were her children to do now? Light the lamps? Wait in darkness? Begin the long march home? No, not yet. Something else was happening. Soldiers were parting the multitude, driving it back, opening a bare, straight strip of land. Right up the hillside it opened, until it reached the theater itself, a stone's throw from where Khandri and Mektu stood. Other troops coaxed the throng back from the moat's edge. Soon, no one remained near the pit's edge save Khandri and his comrades, the honor guard. Even by starlight he could see the strip of emptied land, giving him a clear view of the platform in the distance, and a knot of people that must have been the prophet's retinue. Farther, beyond the crowd's distant edge, the plain ran dark and flat all the way to the coastal range. On the hillside, at the center of that emptied strip, something caught Khandri's eye. Something thin and faint, but very long. A glittering scratch. Could it be a line of paint?
Listen,
someone hissed. In the abrupt silence, Khandri heard it. A rising, churning sound. The roar of voices, many thousands of voices, a throng to rival this one in size. But this new roar came from the mountains, barreling across the plain and up the hill to crack like a whip against the wall of the Theater of Bones. A roar of triumph and pain and liberation and remembered rage. And as it continued, a light appeared. It was a great bonfire, kindled in a notch of the mountains. The shape of the notch was vivid against the starry sky, and an excited murmur reached Khandri's ears.
Hunger Cliff! That's it, where the fire dances! Our prophet stood right there, at the moment of revelation!
The fire grew tall and red, like a devilish candle. Then, was he seeing things? It grew a tentacle. A narrow thread, wriggling down the mountainside, following the contours of the land. The roar seemed to follow its progress, as though new voices were leaping up along the path of the flame. Eventually, the burning thread detached from the bonfire, no longer a tentacle, but a snake. It left the mountains, went slithering over the plain. The roaring grew and grew. The 50,000 near the theater held their breath as suddenly, boom, the snake exploded into a word. A holy word writ in burning oil, and the word was Adranin, imperishable memory. And it lingered there, searing the darkness. But the fire snake emerged anew and kept crawling, the roar still chasing it, growing, and Khandri's heart raced. He was laughing. He was scared out of his mind. Something had been loosed, something so vast that he could not glimpse its shape or purpose, but he knew it could annihilate him, sweep him unnoticed from its path. The fire neared the prophet's retinue, and then, as though tapping richer fuel, it simply leaped up the hill, straight up, like a sword stroke. Khandri barely had time to see the trench, revealed by fire, and the braided wick of oil-soaked rags thick as a palm tree, before the flame roared past the honor guard, leaped the moat, and vanished down a dark stone tunnel into the theater. A full second's silence. Then the world went mad. Every arcade belched fire. A volcanic howl rose to heaven, as though the theater itself were in agony. Khandri was blown off his feet. All around the moat, the honor guard was running or crawling from their stations, the heat impossible, the air turning lethal in their lungs. Only when he was 50 yards from the structure did he dare to look up. The throng was roaring, dancing, possessed. The whole Colosseum had become a torch. The army had filled the theater with fuel as one might fill a bowl with breadcrumbs, but these crumbs burned like hellfire. Hundreds of feet above the wall, the flames were climbing, illuminating the multitude and its sustained, feral cry. Khandri looked for Mektu. There he was, two fists in the air, screaming, transported. And Khandri, yes, he was screaming too. He could not ask why or think why. He could not think at all. Someone doused him with water. His sleeve had caught fire, and he hadn't noticed a thing. Laughing, maniacal. They were not themselves any longer. They were so much more than themselves.
The ghouls!
Someone shouted, and Khandri turned and saw them in the flames. Hairless, hunchbacked creatures, mouths too large, hands too wide, eyes like greasy pools. They had swarmed the arcades, doomed, of course, leaping by threes and fours. Stronger than the men, they writhed and burned upon the spikes, their yowls blending with the roar of the faithful, and they seemed to fight on until the very moment their flesh turned to ash. Silence. Windlessness. Five travelers crossing the white floor of the sea. Condry sways a little, dazzled by the sun, reeling with memory. That night of collective lunacy, of fire, of oaths unto death. Imperishable memory. An army driven by a dream. What force could possibly stand in its way? Then, underfoot, a sudden crackling and crunching. They stop dead. Condry shields his eyes and looks down. They are walking on dragonflies, hundreds of thousands strong, black pearl eyes and rainbow wings, desiccated, dead. All of them facing the same direction, which happens to be their own. As if the swarm had set its collective mind on crossing the East Kralem and flown due east, low and purposeful, moving as one. Until strength abandoned them, or the last trace of water in their bodies, or simply their will. No one speaks. But Condry, walking beside Eshet, notes that her eyes are bright. Waste of water, he can't help but think, though not without a certain admiration. If no one were watching, if Mektu were not watching, perhaps he would have touched her hand. For over a mile, they wade in this river of silver corpses. Then the wind starts to blow, and the insects click and clatter over the salt pan like a curtain of beads.
"You boys haven't thought about it much, then?" says Chindelin.
"I try not to," says Mektu, blinking as he walks. "If I think about it, the dreams come, and that's never good." Talupeke's eyes are inquisitive. She wants the story, chapter and verse. Eshet looks as though she knows it already, somehow.
"We were drugged, boys. You know that," says the smith.
"In more ways than one," Condry says. They walk a mile in silence. Their boots shed translucent wings.
"Well, that is the issue," says the smith. "How many ways? I told you before what I overheard in the weapon shop, how they added something to our food when it suited them. I don't worry any more about the suit sock we drank a year ago. Its purpose was obvious, to make us all maniacs for a night. No, I worry about the drugs we swallowed without tasting anything, without suspecting they were there. The ones that don't seem to have done a thing to us. Yet."
The sun is close to setting when they catch sight of the next pursuit. This time, there are no riders, just three men afoot, and one camel laden with supplies. Chindelin whips out the telescope.
"Pitfire, it's a Tau," he says. "I can see his silver earrings, plain as day. A Tau and two cronies. We never shook them at all."
"They must have been guiding the men who attacked you," says Eshet. "The Tirmassil know the stolen sea better than anyone."
They quicken their pace to a jog. The Tirmassil do the same, drawing no closer but not allowing themselves to slip behind.
"What the hell are they thinking?" says Mektu. "If they did bring the Rasanga, they can see how well that went. And back at a Tau's camp, those little shits ran for their lives when they were still eight strong. Now they're going to try to take us with three?"
"Let's find out," says Condry.
They stop and wait. The Tirmassil carry on for a time, but halt when the distance between them shrinks to half a mile. There they remain, squatting on their heels. A Tau raises a hand and makes a sharp, chopping gesture.
"You know what that means?" says Eshet. "It means, I've come to kill you."
Condry takes a turn with the telescope. He recalls the other Tirmassil from a Tau's camp. The one leading the camel has a thick black and white beard. Very black and very white, like a skunk's tail grafted to his chin. The other is a lanky bald man with a limp. A Tau has his scimitar. The other two carry nail-studded clubs.
"We could walk right over and kill them," says Condry.
That camel would be a blessing.
I don't like this, says Mektu. Why are they so fucking relaxed?
Bewildered, the travelers resume their march.
They're dreaming about a reward from your prophet, says Talupeke. But they'll never see it. Those runts don't know how to fight.
Chindelin takes a last look over his shoulder. Doesn't mean they don't know how to kill, he says. All that night and the next, the Tirmasal dog their heels, turning when Khandri's party turns, pitching camp when they pitch camp. From beneath their own sunshield, they laugh and hurl taunts in the Parthian tongue. Eshet says they are shouting, "Food for the worms." The wind is in their faces, as it has been since Belanger, and this does nothing to help Khandri's irritated eyes. But a worse torment is his inability to guess a Tau's game. An ambush seems impossible. The way ahead is clear for miles. Still, to quell their doubts, they veer north several times, adding miles to the journey. The Tirmasal make no effort to drive them south again. They do not seem to care where they go. Midway through the third night, they find themselves on the edge of a great north-south rift. Before them, the land falls away to depths Khandri cannot gauge by moonlight. Far below, the land once more becomes smooth and flat, but what will it take to get down there? The downward slope, though comprised of the same loose salt scree, is very steep. When Mektu heaves a rock over the edge, a great mass of earth breaks free and slides into the darkness. Eshet swears and turns her face away. Khandri himself feels dizzy at the sight.
We can manage this, he makes himself say. But for the love of Aang, watch your step. And if you do fall, keep your head uphill and lie flat. If you start rolling, there'll be nothing left of you at the bottom but a sack of bones.
Under 10 feet of dirt, says Chindelin.
Pull out that rope, Khandri, and we'll pass it around our waists. If one of us stumbles, the others might be able to stop him.
Mektu removes his headscarf and ties one end to his belt. He offers the other end to Eshet.
Hold this, too, he says. I said I'd protect you, and I will.
Eshet looks at him with great unease, but she takes the scarf. The descent is slow and terrifying. Large masses of salt and earth shear away with their every footfall, rushing before them like breaking waves. Khandri's boots are overflowing. The rope snaps and jerks.
At least we'll be rid of the Tirmasal, says Mektu. No camels descending this. Not in the dark, anyway.
You're right, says Khandri. But he thinks, wouldn't a Tau know about the rift? Then Eshet screams. Before Khandri can even turn to look, she and Mektu crash against him, and the three are borne together against Talupeke and Chindelin. Khandri stabs his fists into the earth but can find no purchase. They are tangled, choking, gathering speed. He flails over and over. So easy to die. So much unfinished. He sees his parents' faces. He feels Arikina naked in his arms. Then a flash of steel. Chindelin has rolled and swung his axe. Snap! The rope goes taut, tearing at Khandri's ribs. He can feel himself slowing and claws at the earth once again. The smith has done it, buried his axe deep enough to bite. The others, too, have regained some control. They never stop, but they are riding the wave now rather than being crushed. In a matter of seconds, they are all at the bottom, heaped atop one another, in a cloud of dust that hides the stars. Eshet clings to Mektu, shaking, too frightened to move. His arms are tight about her head.
8 more miles. Flashes of heat lightning. On the wind, faint, curious smells. Sulfur, citrus, pitch. Low in the northeast, the twin red stars called Jekka's eyes.
3 in the morning. The brothers' aunts used to whisper, when all good boys are asleep, that's when the Lord of Hell peeks over the world's rim to search for sinners.
The old man would chuckle and say he doubted it was much of a search. The aunts would study him and scowl.
At dawn, the weather changes. A cold wind blows up from the south.
The night's chill lingers, bracing and almost bewildering after so many days when the heat burst upon them with the sun. And as the light grows, they see an astonishing sight. It resembles a broad river, meandering across their path. But this river is stationary and composed of pools, thousands upon thousands of irregular oval pools, each one a brilliant shade of green or turquoise. Some are enormous, others no larger than a child's wading pool. From several, a mist or steam is rising. The pools crowd together with almost no gaps, only diaphanous edges barely visible in the glare. Beyond the river, the land begins immediately to rise. Sharp hills stand on the horizon. It is a scene of such weird loveliness that for a moment no one speaks. Then Mektu comes to life.
"Is that water?"
he asks.
"Sort of," says Talupeke.
The others look at her, bewildered. She frowns, touches her temple.
"It's mud," she says after a moment. "And salts, spirits, minerals."
"The biles of the earth," breaks in Chindelin. "Ong's grace, I remember. Garatajik talked about this place. He called it the snakeskin."
Talupeke looks pleased, as though Chindelin has found a puzzle piece lost in a corner.
"The snakeskin, that's right. We've reached the very bottom of the stolen sea."
"The part that never quite drained," says Chindelin. "Garatajik says that there are cracks beneath those pools leading down to the stomach of Uroth. That's how he speaks of hell, and that evil things bubble up from below. That explains the colors, maybe. What's certain is we've made good time. Remember your nursery tales, boys? The cold east depths, near the fair east shore, bring me to harbor, and I'll sail no more. We're getting close. In short order, we should get a glimpse of the rim."
"But how do we cross all those pools?" asks Mektu.
"Carefully," says Talupeke.
"They have skins, like ice, but made of salt and other things. You can walk on some of them, but others..."
She breaks off, rubbing her temples again.
"What? What?" says Mektu. "Are they poisonous? Is that what you mean?" "Worse, I think. Something's very wrong about this place."
She pauses, looks at them almost guiltily.
"But I can't fucking remember. I was drinking a Tau's wine by then."
"What do you remember?" asks Eshet. The girl stares into the distance beyond the pools.
"That there are only so many ways up the east rim," she says at last. "The cliffs are taller on that side. There are a few staircases, but they're hard to spot. We need to find one of the old ports like Mab Makutin."
"You've been there?" says Condri.
"I grew up on the east rim," says Talupeke. "But Mab Makutin is barely a city anymore. The name means ghost port, but they called it Makutharim, king's port, before the theft of the sea. My grandmother says that 100,000 lived there in its richest days, but now," she shrugs, 9,000? 10? No one can tell you, really. No one counts anymore."
"How close are we, girl?" asks Mektu. Talupeke scowls at him, struggling.
"A day's march," she says.
"A long day, maybe," says Eshet.
"This time it's all uphill."
She stops abruptly. The others turn to her in surprise.
"This time?" says Condri.
Eshet's jaw is tight as she speaks.
"I made the crossing once," she says, "in the other direction. A Tirmasal gang brought me to Eternity Camp over the Stolen Sea. They had too many Parthen girls in the east, they said. They had to spread us around."
"So you are a Parthen," says Chindelin.
Again, the hesitation.
"Parthen, yes," she says at last. "But you, Chiloto, don't know the meaning of the word. There are many of us, far more than you imagine, and many kinds of desert blood. Some of us build great townships, grow grain where the land permits. Some are hunters only. Some follow the wild herds."
"What about your people?" Condri asks.
"We are 9-year Parthens. We are nomads, travelers. But when we find a good place,
We build a house for the dead and live around it for 9 years. My kin built their house 3 years ago. I have time to find them. Time to get back.
Atau looked a little frightened of you, says Chindelin.
He should be, says Eshet. Everyone fears my people, but the Tir Mossel most of all. If we catch them, we slit their throats. But they keep coming, pretending to be merchants, bringing knives or lamp oil or other things we need. They cheat us, but that is not why we kill them. Everyone cheats us. Only the Tir Mossel buy and sell us like dogs. They raise some of our children themselves and teach them to hate their Parthan blood, to hide it, to be ashamed. They tell the children that their parents are cannibals and would kill and eat them if they returned. By the time those children are half grown, they are ready to go back and steal more Parthan women and children. She takes a deep breath. That's how they got me. They sent a man with a Parthan face who said he had come from Shafetzi. He seemed kind. We trusted him. One day he surprised me early in the morning on my walk back from the well. I've come to save you from this life, he told me, and threw a sack over my head.
She looks at Chindelin.
You and Talupeke are both right. Tir Mossel are bad warriors, but very good with disguises, with tricks.
What happened to you then? Asks Condri. Eshet looks away to the west.
They locked us in a shed. We were there for a week, and two girls died of thirst. When they came for the bodies, they told us that we were going to Eternity Camp to work in the kitchens. The kitchens! I believed that, even though I'd been dragged away from my village by force. I didn't want to believe anything else. They brought us down the cliff by a long staircase, and then they stacked us on camels and brought us here. We were blindfolded, but I could hear the talk about the snakeskin and feel the camel wading across. Not all the pools are dangerous. The men walked ahead, smashing the salt ice, searching. It took a long time. Then we traveled south to a hidden cave where the Tir Mossel meet to do their business. You can get anything there. Wine, drugs, sapphires, holy relics, books, and children, and whores. I was lucky. The Tir Mossel didn't rape me because they wanted me clean.
She looks at Condri and Mektu.
The Prophet's warriors need new girls all the time. Fresh girls, virgins. They don't ever have enough.
Condri drops his eyes. He feels ill. He wishes he had something to break or stomp to pieces. But Mektu is gaping.
You, he says. I remember. We made love.
Eshet looks capable of murder.
We did not, she says. Make love. You're wrong. We did, says Mektu. You were a substitute for the chubby girl. I'd saved up for her especially, but it was all right. You were perfectly adequate. I decided then and there not to ask for a discount, and later we talked about...
Eshet slaps him. The sound so odd and intimate. The silence that follows is different as well, out of place somehow. The hush of a bedroom in that vast open land. The smells that began in the night grow stronger, especially the rotten egg sulfur stench. But the wind remains cool. Talupeke says that she has known such days in midwinter, days that start with a flood of cold air from the southwest. Chindelin has heard of them too. Cold roars is the army term. Blissful, but not to be counted on. The scalding heat could return in a day's time, or an hour's.
And when it does, where are we going to bed down? Not much shade near the snakeskin, and those hills must be 8 or 10 miles off. Garatajik knew what he was about when he told us to travel by night.
Well, we can't wait for nightfall here, says Mektu. There's no shade at all. We'll fry like shrimp in a skillet.
The choice is clear enough. To press on while the cool wind lasts, or backtrack more than an hour and dig in at the foot of the rift. Chindelin and Eshet favor a retreat. Mektu and Talupeke are for pressing on.
If we run out of water, we die,
says Eshet softly.
Listen to her. Listen to the Parthen, says Chindelin. We have water for 2 days and nights. If we're caught out in the heat, we could drink that much before the sun sets today.
And if we're caught by the Rasanga, it won't matter how much water we have, says Mektu. He looks around for Khandri. Brother, are you even listening? Why don't you say something?
I will, but you won't like it, says Khandri, pointing west across the flats. Two men are walking swiftly in their direction.
Son of a bitch, says Mektu. It's the same god's damned Tir Mossel, I'm sure of it.
Chindelin whips out the scope.
Mektu's right, he says. It's a Tau, and that bald fellow with the club. They must have left the third man with the camel, looking for another way down.
The man in front makes the familiar gesture, chop, chop.
No,
says Mektu. What do you mean, no, says Khandri.
Mektu turns him a dismayed look.
No, he's not looking for a way down. He's riding back to alert the Rasanga, riding hard. They finally realize that they can't fight us, and that we're not going to die before we reach the rim. So they're going back to find the wolf pack. And I'd bet my last gam they have a horn or a drum, something to call those bastards in.
Then why aren't they sounding it? Asks Khandri.
Mektu bites the middle of his thumb, as he has always done when thinking furiously. Suddenly his eyes light up.
Because they're waiting too. Waiting for a signal. They've already met the wolf pack, right? So someone in the pack must have a horn as well, and he'll sound it when they're closing in. That's how they'll find each other. That's how they'll find us.
Spotters, says Chindelin. Why didn't we think of that before?
He looks at Mektu with grudging respect.
If they are spotters, says Talupeke, then we need to kill them. Right now.
Khandri looks across the glittering half-mile. We can try, he says. Covertly, they check their belts and weaponry, then turn and charge the Tir Mossel. But as expected, a Tau and the bald man turn tail once again. After several pointless minutes, Khandri calls a halt.
This is crazy, he says. They're as fast as we are.
We'll have to lighten our load, says Talupeke. Two of us can kill those fools. The others can wait with the packs.
They're cowards, no doubt, says Chindelin. But which of us are the fools? Here we are, chasing them, wasting our water, wasting our strength.
Going blind, says Mektu.
Damned right we are. And all the while...
The others look at him, and the same thought is written in all their faces. The real pursuit, the wolf pack.
Let's get out of here, says Eshet.
They turn east and run. The Tir Mossel hoot and jeer. Food for the worms, worms, worms. Khandri fights down a tremor of panic. The sun is now directly in their eyes. He pulls his headscarf forward and lowers his gaze, but that solves only half the problem. The salt-glazed earth is dazzling enough. Worse yet, the wind is still rising and carrying with it a fine grit, almost a powder. Each gust seems determined to fling the grit in their faces. Khandri's eyes are streaming. The world flutters when he blinks. At daybreak, he had thought the snakeskin close, but now it seems to recede the more they rush toward it. For 2 hours, they slog into the wind, increasingly dazzled, hands cupped around their eyes. When Khandri glances back, he finds that the Tir Mossel have donned large, floppy hoods that hide their faces. It seems a poor solution. If the grit can blow up Khandri's sleeves to his armpits, it can blow into those hoods. But bandits too get desperate, don't they? Especially if they've nearly had you, nearly served you up for dinner with an apple in your mouth, only to find you've caught wind of their trick and might yet escape. The ground goes soft, and there at last is the snakeskin, blazing and shimmering before them. As Talupeke has said, the pools are topped with flat crystal skins, very much like ice. The rims of the pools are jagged walls of salt scree, like irregular pie crusts. Some reach a height of several yards, but most barely rise above the pools. None are more than a few inches wide. Khandri creeps to the edge of the nearest pool, a lovely bird's egg blue, and gingerly tests the ice. There is an audible crack. A web of fractures radiates from his boot.
No way in hell, he says.
They're all different, though, says Eshet. Some have ice strong enough for a caravan to cross. Some are boiling, others very deep. The Tirmasu believed that the light green pools were perfectly safe. They broke the ice there and let the camels wade. But other pools scared them so badly they wouldn't go near. Don't ask me which. They seemed afraid even to talk about them.
As expected, Atau and the bald Tirmasil have stopped again, this time somewhat closer to the travelers. With their hoods over their eyes, they look more foolish than menacing, but they go on laughing and jeering.
Fuck them, says Condri.
Girl, do you remember anything about how you crossed?
We walked on the rims, says Talupeke, but also on the ice. We did both.
That's an enormous help, says Chindelin. Lucky we brought you along.
Talupeke spins like a top and kicks the smith in the ass. Chindelin goes sprawling. As the others shout at her, she turns and runs along the shore. When she reaches the edge of the light blue pool, she steps out nimbly onto the rim. The top inch of crust shatters like fine crystal, but the rim bears her weight. She runs a dozen yards, pivots on one foot, and looks back at the others.
Well?
They follow. Talupeke makes the task look easy.
Circus freak, mutters Chindelin.
But no one else finds it so. Condri and Eshet move with some confidence, but Mektu sways and lurches, and Chindelin takes only mincing steps. Behind them, the Tirmasil move nearer to the shore. Impatient, Talupeke roams ahead and tests the skin of the nearest pools. None will bear their weight. Condri, at the rear of the procession, looks hopelessly across the beautiful, threatening mosaic of the snakeskin. Which pools could a man wade if necessary? Which would kill him at a touch? Or draw him down into bottomless, slowly thickening mud? How many travelers were entombed there already, suspended forever, ants trapped in glue? He has seen a legion of ghosts in the skies above him. Is there another trapped below?
Old friend Fear, he thinks, always turning up with gifts.
Churning stomach, wasteful sweat, but gods, gods, to die that way, in a closed black trap. Condri is almost grateful for the distraction of pain in his eyes. That pain is real and growing. The powdery grit blows unimpeded over the salt ice, and the wind is rising still. With each step, they must fight harder for balance. Even Talupeke is concentrating now, fists rubbing brutally at her eyes. Chindelin is bent almost double. He looks like an old man fording a stream.
Uncle, Condri thinks, how could I do this to you?
The next three pools, pea green, sky blue, sapphire, also prove too fragile to cross. Some of the taller rims are impassable as well, walls of teeth as high as their chins. Time and again, they are forced to retrace their steps. An hour into the effort, they are less than halfway across. The two Tirmasil have now reached the shore of the snakeskin. They stand there facing the travelers, deep hoods flapping in the wind, no longer bothering to gesture or to laugh.
Brother, says Mektu.
What is it, Mek?
I was all wrong, you know.
About crossing today?
No. Well, maybe yes. Or definitely yes. Of course, you never even hazarded a guess.
Condri is fighting savagely for calm.
Will you please, he says, just spit it out?
They're not helping a wolf pack, says Mektu. They want the bounty for themselves. And I think they might get it.
What, by killing us? Just the two of them? Why the hell do you say that?
Because I'm blind?
Mek.
Condri gropes for his shoulder.
Don't fuck with me. You're totally blind?
Almost totally. And I know their plan now, Condri. This time I know. Your eyes are going, too.
They're going. I'm not blind yet, but...
Waves of color, of mesmerizing light, travel constantly across his gaze. He is seeing the world through schools of fish. Blinking hard, He looks at the others. Eshet staggering, Talupeke furiously rubbing her eyes, Chindelen still creeping along with that exaggerated caution of his. Exaggerated? Or the caution of a blind man? Condry looks back over his shoulder, and suddenly the whole game is clear. The two Tirmasil have thrown back their hoods. They are wearing tight masks over the upper half of their faces. Masks and goggles. A circle of darkest glass for each eye.
Salt blindness, says Mektu. Like snow blindness in the mountains. We should have guessed, Condry. Eshet said they kept her blindfolded.
Salt blindness. And the Tirmasil have guarded themselves against it. Probably during every daylight hour, except when their faces might have been seen. We've got to run, Mech. Right now.
No, hisses Mektu. We've got to keep up appearances. They're hungry. Can't you feel it?
Hungry?
They're set to pounce, Condry. They're just waiting on our blindness, waiting.
Crash. Talupeke has fallen through the ice. She rises, staggering, covered in turquoise mud. Chindelen and Eshet grope for her, pawing at the air.
For us to give ourselves away.
All bedlam erupts. Talupeke climbs from the pool with a sustained howl of madness or agony. The Tirmasil step onto the rim and move swiftly toward Condry and Mektu. The brothers try to double their speed and barely save themselves from a head-first plunge. Talupeke backhands Chindelen, still reaching for her blindly, and when Eshet tries to steady him, they fall and vanish through the ice of the adjacent pool. Talupeke shows no concern for their plight, or no awareness. She draws her knives and slashes at random, screaming her bestial scream. Condry tries to shove his brother forward.
Move your ass, they're drowning!
But Mektu has told the truth. He is very nearly blind. Condry could force his way past him, but what then? Leave him standing here, waiting for a Tau? Curtains of fire, sprays of orange stars. Condry blinks furiously. There, thank Ong, are Chindelen and Eshet, surfacing, clawing at the pool's rim, breaking off large chunks of salt. Behind them, the bald Tirmasil shouts with laughter. At the sound, Talupeke whirls, swaying in the wind. Then she lunges toward the sound, thrashing waist-deep through the turquoise pool she has just escaped. Sudden, searing pain in his leg. One of the Tirmasil has thrown a rock. A second rock flies past his ear. What if they have bags of rocks? They could stand at a distance, stone the four of them to death.
God's brother, he says. I'm going to have to fight them. We should split up, says Mektu. They want both our heads. I can't fight. A six-year-old could kill me now, but I might draw one of them off. I'm not leaving you.
Talupeke wades closer, smashing ice with her fists. Condry shuts his eyes for a precious moment. They can't have many rocks. The shore is all fine scree. Knock an arrow. Hold them off. He opens his eyes again. Pain and fire. But for a moment, he does see more clearly. The effect is slight and lasts not half a second, but it is real. He shuts his eyes for a full 5 seconds. Again, fleeting clarity, followed by deeper blindness, searing pain. As if his eyes have shed a burning garment and then passed naked when he opens them back into a flame.
Condry, why are you stopping? Talk to me!
Red pinwheels, spools of burning wire. The Tirmasil are within 30 yards. Forget the bow. If one of them gets past it, you're dead. Use the machete. Don't kill Mech on the backswing. Talupeke is closer than the men, still erupting with high, horrific screams. They reach the next pool, and Condry kicks at it with his boot. The ice seems to hold.
Step down, Mech. Hold my arm.
It is a large pool. The ice crackles ominously as they run across it. Like invalids, like clowns. Condry is nauseous with pain. Every blink is a nightstick. What if his balance goes? What if he faints? Maybe they will hesitate.
Maybe the crackling of the ice will give them pause.
Con,
Mektu whispers.
We've got to fool them, like they fooled us, only better.
Somehow Condry knows his brother is right.
I can still see, he says.
It's getting worse, but I can fight them. I can try. If they don't wait too long.
They've waited for days, says Mektu.
Right again. The men are cowards. Smart fucking cowards. Condry draws the machete from his belt.
I'll pretend I'm stone blind then.
I'll look in the wrong direction. That's what they're waiting for, isn't it?
Yes, but...
Mektu bites his thumb.
It's not sly enough. Not for a weasel like a Tau.
What would be sly enough?
I don't know. Something twisted. Think like me, brother. Think like me.
Condry wants to hit him. Why don't you fucking think like you? Suddenly, a Tau shouts at the bald man. Go kill the other two before we lose the smith under the ice. Bring back his weapons and his head. I should be finished here, but if not, we'll use that bow of his. Get along.
But that crazy bitch is coming this way,
cries the bald man. What do we care, says a Tau. Just stay good and quiet when she passes. She used to throw those knives blindfolded, you know. It was part of her act. Telupeke's roars grow louder. Condry looks back and sees her barely 20 feet from them, staggering, striking at ghosts. I could kill you, she'd warned them. He tugs at Mektu's arm.
Girl! Shouts Mektu suddenly. Over here!
Shut up!
Condry clubs him, hissing. Oh, Mech, why do you do it, you stupid ass, every fucking time?
Too late. Telupeke whirls and lumbers in their direction, thin ice breaking around her knees. A Tau stands perfectly still. When she reaches the brothers' pool, she climbs up onto the ice and crouches low. Condry holds his breath. Telupeke flicks the mud from her knives.
Girl,
says Mektu. Telupeke charges, slashing at the air. Condry shoves his brother from her path with all his strength and dives in the opposite direction. She lunges between them, screaming murder, and the knife in her left hand passes inches from Condry's neck. Out of the blur of limbs and fire, he snatches one glimpse of her face. Madness, terror, an eye like a wounded horse. She doesn't see him. She rages on across the ice. A few pools scared the Tirmassal so badly they wouldn't go near them. Did one of those release a madness already latent in the girl, or inflict something new? Condry watches her, a blur swiftly vanishing, a young girl seen through tears. Soldier gone. Killer, freak, fucked up child, gone. Misery and rage clot in his chest, his throat. He staggers to his feet and draws his machete.
Is that the blade that killed O'Julon?
A Tau's voice is casual. He is on the ice and starting to circle the brothers, his masked head like an insect's, his scimitar in hand. Condry struggles to see him, a phantom among searing clouds. Not sly enough, Mektu had said. Right a third time. You can't act stone blind unless you let a Tau move behind you, and I'll be God's damned if I'll let him behind me. He pivots. Mektu crouches by his knee, staring in the wrong direction. We have to fool him. How? How? What trick do you spring on a master of tricks? Condry pivots again. Mektu clings to his leg.
Brother, kill me, he says. Bring your hand down. Here. Here's my neck.
The weeping has started. Mektu has snapped. In a burst of fury, Condry kicks him away. Mektu falls hard, face smashing against the ice. When a Tau makes a dart at him, Condry swings his blade in a wild arc.
Your brother has the right idea, says a Tau. It's better this way, honestly. When the Prophet collects you, think about it now. You don't want to be anything but dead. The Rasanga could work you over for a year or more. They talked around our fire, you know. Small slashes, tiny tools like cheese graters, unimaginable pain. Then tourniquets, amputation when necessary. But worse than any of that, at least to judge by their own fear, would be simply to give you to the white child.
Can you tell me about this child? What the hell is it? What makes a Rasanga's blood run cold?
Kill me, says Mektu again.
But there's no need for your brother to kill you, says Atau. I'll do you both if you can just get him to cooperate. Lie down on your stomachs, or if you want to pray first, go ahead. I don't mind.
Khandri lunges again. What is he attempting? To kill Atau? To deceive him? Deceive him how?
I can't do this. Mektu should be doing this. Think like Mektu. Pretend you're...
A kind of lightning grips his mind. He straightens, finds his balance. Then he leaps a third time, and Atau jumps back.
Khandri snarls at him.
I can see you, pig.
Of course you can, says Atau. You led your brother by the arm, didn't you? I know you're not quite blind. It's coming, though. Probably sooner than you think.
Come and get me.
Oh, I will.
You're a shit-scared little eunuch, says Khandri. If my dog fucked your mother, I'd say a prayer for the dog. Where did she have you? In a sewer? On a heap of rotting...
Atau flings grit in his face.
It's no good, says the Tirmassal. I won't blunder to my death because you've angered me. Try again.
Stabbing pain. The salt grit gnaws at Khandri's eyes. The streaks of light are expanding, crowding out what he sees. He moves through a halting, blinkered battle dance, memory and practice guiding his feet. But Atau is maddeningly patient. He knows very well what to look for, it seems.
Khandri has a momentary glimpse of his face. Black mask, insolent grin. I like you, Chiloto, he tells Khandri. You're about to make me rich.
The machete's grip is slippery. Khandri dries his palm on his shirt. One card left to play. He swings, but makes sure that his blow falls short of Atau. He makes himself stumble, lets the machete bite into the earth.
That's more like it, says Atau, delighted. You're half blind and worsening fast, but at least you're thinking. What to do? Feign total blindness and lure me in? No, no, that can't be done safely. I might not fall for it. Feign normal vision and scare me off? But you know I won't go far.
So you make a bold choice. You pretend to be pretending you can still see well enough. And then you fake a slip-up, a tell.
The very tell you think I'm looking for. You hope I'll rush in to finish you off and give you a last clean shot at me. Not bad. Not bad at all. But let me say it again, boy. I can wait.
And for the next quarter hour, he does. Khandri leaps and stabs and never comes close to landing a blow. His eyes stream. His head is throbbing. His vision contracts to a few scattered points. He anchors himself on his useless brother, who is curled into a ball, sobbing, crushed, facing what Khandri cannot. Beaten, skinned and gutted, outfoxed. He makes a desperate lunge, hacking at any hint of movement. Atau throws more grit at him, and the world goes black. It is as if a piece of the sun has dropped and burst before his eyes. Brilliance and fire, then purest night. No grays, no shadows. He is blind. A terrible silence has fallen. Atau gives him nothing. Not a footfall, not a breath.
Khandri swings his blade in a circle. Two times around, three.
The pain at the pit of his eyeballs, the burn. He thinks, blindness, too, is a sort of drowning. And with that, his balance deserts him, and he falls.
Atau kicks the machete from his hand. Roll over, boy. Cross your arms beneath your chest. I'll make this clean. You won't feel anything. And the pain in your eyes and the pain in your heart, all that will cease.
Condry flails toward the voice. His fingers brush boot leather, close on nothing. Atau's second kick is to his face. He falls, and his mouth gushes blood. The third kick is to his groin.
"Or, if you're difficult," says Atau, rattled, "I'll just bleed you out, you fucking Chiloto dog. I make it easy for you, and what do I get? You ought to be kissing my boot, not..."
His voice is cut off with a sound like a slurp. Condry flinches. Blood sprays his face. He starts to rise, and Atau crashes against him, lifeless, slashed open at the neck. A pair of hands seizes the body and shoves it aside.
"He should have waited a bit longer. Mektu. Oh, gods, Mektu. You're a terrible actor, brother. Fortunately, I'm not."
Mektu can still see. He has guessed the danger earliest, pinched his eyes shut the soonest, blinking only occasionally for the benefit of Atau. Now he is wearing the dead man's goggles. He says his vision is bad and blurry, but getting no worse. He cannot see the bald Tirmasil or the other travelers. He can barely see the shore. He mops the blood from Condri's face, then winds a thick bandage around his head.
"You could have told me what you were up to," says Condry.
"Wrong," says Mektu. "It was you who made Atau believe in my blindness. You never suspected, so neither did he." Condry himself remains perfectly sightless, and strangely resigned. It feels almost good to be helpless, to be led along the jagged rims, across strong ice. But a new danger confronts them already. The wind has finally turned, and the heat is building. They shout for the others, but hear no reply.
"We need shade," says Condry. "I'm sweating already. We can't make it to the hills."
"There is no shade anywhere," says Mektu. "Then we'll have to get ashore and pitch the sunshield." He stops dead.
"Oh, gods, Mech, the sunshield.
What about it?
The damn thing's in Uncle's pack."
Mektu begins to swear, quietly and steadily, as though urinating. He drags Condry north. "Something different about the ice there," and then curses again. It is only blue mud splashed on the rim.
"Maybe Miss Trouble waded through this one. Maybe it's the one that drove her mad. I don't know. I can't fucking tell where we are."
He sighs. "At least we haven't fallen into one of these damn things. Just don't wipe your hands on your pants. There's green mud splashed up to your..." He freezes, gripping Condry's wrist.
"A body," he says.
"What? Where?"
"It's the bald man, a Tau's sidekick, and..."
"Oh.
Be careful," says Condry. "The bastard might be faking death."
"Not likely." Mektu's voice is odd. He leads Condry closer, painting the scene in words. The Tirmasil is chest deep in a small cobalt pool, arms stretched forward, hands clawing at the ice. Evidently, he had walked about 6 steps before it shattered, then tried and failed to pull himself free.
"The pool's not mud. It's a clear blue with lots of bubbles. It's very pretty, actually."
"Why are you so sure he's dead?" says Condry.
"Because he's a gooey skeleton from the ribs down, and the bones are going too. That liquid's eating him, melting him away."
"Devil's ass! Steady, brother! Don't fall." Which is worse, to see the corpse plainly, as Mektu does, or to imagine it, half dissolved, a man turning to slime?
"Let's get out of here," Condry says.
"Hold on," says Mektu. "Something else on the ice."
"Huh. Isn't that...
curious. I suppose it's what he was after.
What is it? Tell me."
"Big bloody knife."
"A dagger, you mean?"
Mektu releases him, crouches down.
"No, not a dagger. It's a madeglin.
A beautiful madeglin. All jewels and gold." Minutes later, Condry is holding Lord O'Julon's priceless weapon, which his brother has knocked to the edge of the pool with a few well-aimed chunks of ice. Condry feels the big stone set in the pommel,
the gold tracery on the blade, the small sharp rubies, the flame-like teeth near the tip. He is dumbfounded.